It is abundantly clear, to some painfully clear, that we're in the midst of a transition to an Asian century or even epoch. It's not just the booming powerhouse economies and militaries of India and China. It's the, what one might say, the detumescence of Western powers. Europe in disarray, the US is essentially withdrawing from the Asia-Pacific, and it's failed to win what is now, well, a nearly two-decade war in the Middle East. But how should we interpret the rise of China and India and the decline of the West? My next guest argues that what we're experiencing is, in fact, a return to the historical status quo. Jason argues that Western dominance of the global system was an anomaly, and we need to understand that in order to get a grip on our present and future. Jason Sharman, Professor of International Relations at Cambridge, the new book, as I said, Empires of the Weak. An Aussie by birth, as you will hear. Jason's been with us before. His previous book was The Despot's Guide to Wealth Management, and that was about corruption in the international system. And to help us launch our new year of Late Night Lives, Jason joins me from the London studio. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
One of your criticisms of how we've understood the rise of the West is that we've seen it as a story which culminates or ends with Western domination of the global system in the 19th and 20th century.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a bad tendency in amongst social scientists, but also policymakers as well, to take what they believe to be the end of the story and then reinterpret all of the preceding history, really to kind of shift it, to sort it, to distort it in such a way as it becomes this rather triumphal march to what we imagine to be the end of the story, namely the Western dominance of the international system.
But as you point out, in contrast, if the end of the story is any time after decolonization or the recent resurgence of powers like China, the story becomes very different.
Indeed, the story of Western domination is probably misleading for two senses. One, of course, we don't know how the story ends, but crystal ball gazing into the 21st century, it seems at least as likely that Asian powers will be dominant rather than the continued dominance of Western powers. Secondly, it's a rather kind of potted and unreliable guide to most of the history of the last 500 years. So it's both retrospectively and prospectively not very helpful.
You point out that Western scholars have posed the question, how did Europe come to dominate the world? They've had, and I quote, an unabashed conviction that Europeans were inherently superior to other races, even though this has been discredited. Those biases linger.
Yeah, very much so. That obviously, this was previously in the form of kind of outright racist beliefs, but I think in the 20th century, there's still been a lingering belief in the technological and institutional superiority of Westerners, and which is supposedly, so the story goes, explains why to both the West to the Americas and the East to Asia, it's commonly, though mistakenly, assumed that Europeans dominated foreign policies when they ventured across the seas in the early modern period.
When did this Eurocentrism begin, in your view, Jason?
In some ways, it was always there from the start. It's probably not too surprising that each civilization has views about its own centrality and superiority. But of course, it's the ability of scholarship, both in history and the social sciences, the fact that that's come to be dominated by the West, that's meant that the Western view of international relations or history has tended to become the dominant view. And as I say, this really distorts our ability to take a clear-eyed view of what's possibly in store for us, but also to understand the big trends in history over the last five centuries.
In introducing you, I neglected to observe an ongoing tradition of the program, and that is to have the guest explain the name of the named chair, Sir Patrick Shea. You're the Patrick Shea Professor. Who is or was he?
Sir Patrick, she is still around, and the chair was named after him. He led a policy inquiry into Britain in the early 1990s, and that's the inquiry for which he received his knighthood. So in that sense, a little bit of overlap between his inquiry into policing and some of the research I do, not so much in this book, but as you referred to earlier, to do with corruption and money laundering.
Now, in the book, you argue that we've misunderstood the West's brief tenure at the top, because we overplay the importance of the military revolution that occurred in Europe in the early modern period. Take us through this argument.
Sure, this is the idea that supposedly Europe was a uniquely warlike and competitive place, and that because of this existential struggle for survival that faced European rulers, that Europeans got particularly good at waging war in two senses. First off, Europeans could invent better engines of war, particularly guns and gunpowder weapons. And secondly, that Europeans were better at inventing institutions that enabled the resource mobilization of money, of men, of all the things that it takes to fight a war, and that was namely states. So this idea that superior technology, mainly guns, and superior institutions, mainly states, gave Europeans a superiority in conducting warfare, that although developed in Europe for European circumstances, when these capacities were exported overseas to the Americas, to Africa and to Asia, supposedly gave Europeans an advantage, and then, the story continues, explain the rise of European global empires and the subordination of civilizations outside of Europe.
But you argue that in fact that Europe did not have a technological superiority, at least in the early stage of this era.
Yeah, for most of the time that we've had an international system, which you could say is roughly 500 years since Christopher Columbus and Vasco da Gama, that in fact Europeans haven't had a military superiority really anywhere, including in Europe. They've been at parity, sometimes superiority, but just as much inferiority. And that in fact Europeans, when they've gone overseas, for the most of the time did so on a basis of deferring to more powerful local civilizations. And in fact European expansion often had more to do with European subordination than dominance.
Well, if we look at the case of the Mesoamericans, a tiny group of conquistadors arrive and in a sense use a pre-existing mythology and disease to dominate.
Yes, I mean, certainly disease was very important in the progress of the conquistadors and then the Portuguese in the Americas. But also, of course, it's a very small group of conquistadors with a very large group of local allies. So you might have a couple of hundred Spaniards, but tens of thousands of local allies amongst the American Indians there. And the second part of that story tends to get left out. So what was in some sense a local civil war with some role for a bunch of foreigners from the Iberian Peninsula becomes transformed into a story of tiny groups of Europeans overcoming huge forces of Americans. Again, not really the story.
Talking to Jason Sharman about Empires of the Weak, the real story of European expansion and the creation of the New World Order, an old friend of mine and of the program is Simon Winchester, and by eerie coincidence, I've just been rereading one of his masterpieces, The Man That Loved China, which reminds us, Jason, of the technological dazzlements that the Chinese have historically produced.
Exactly. Starting off, of course, with gunpowder, that for a long time European scholars were pretty reluctant to admit the fact that the Chinese, not Europeans, had invented both gunpowder and gunpowder weapons. And in some ways, it's the progress of Europe from around about 1500 was really catching up with things that in many cases the Chinese had done first 500 years earlier. And so what we like to think of as a process of westernization, in some ways and in military terms, is in fact a belated process of Sinification. As Europe came to replicate advances earlier made in China.
You say there definitely were massive military innovations in Europe, however. For example, tactical change came about with Dutch reformers adapting a classic Roman linear battlefield formation.
That's true. There were big changes in the way that Europeans fought wars after the end of the medieval period, partly to do with changing technology. But if we look at the implications of this for the wider world, the kind of disjuncture or the fly in the ointment for the conventional story is that Europeans fought wars in Europe very differently from the way that they engaged in their expeditions and conquest outside Europe. And in fact, the big advances in Europe, tactical and the size of arms, armies and institutional progress in terms of states. If we look at what Europeans were doing in Africa, Asia, and the Americas, it was tiny groups of Europeans, generally kind of freelancers or operating on a semi-private basis, and using almost none of the tactics and strategies that characterized war in Europe at the same time.
Clearly, Europe managed to convince itself not only of its racial superiority, but also its technological superiority. We also did a pretty good demolition job, did we not, on convincing, at least for some time, convincing the Chinese that they were pretty much a subject or a spent force.
That's true. That was certainly a great time of soul-searching during the so-called century of humiliation for China. Of course, the Chinese had a pretty good line themselves in thinking that they were the center of the world and superior to all of the barbarian civilizations that surrounded them. So in that sense, just like there's Eurocentrism, there's Sinocentrism too.
But of course, that conviction, that inner belief in the Middle Kingdom and of Chinese centrality is now coming back to the fore.
That's right. So we obviously have the return of China, particularly with the fantastic growth rates of the Chinese economy since 1978, and the more particular rise of Xi Jinping since December 2012. But in some ways, I mean, China underrates its achievements. China's an empire too. Just like the Europeans went to other places and conquered them, so too did the Chinese. But in some ways, the Chinese empire lasts today. Although for all the things that the Chinese government likes to talk about in terms of national achievements, perhaps coercive empire building is one of the ones that gets less play than it should.
You also attack the idea that Europeans perfected modern warfare because they were constantly fighting each other. And in doing so, they were honing their skills in a kind of Darwinian struggle for dominance.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of a common assumption, not just in warfare, but in lots of things, that practice makes perfect, that organizations learn to do what they do better through a process of either learning or elimination. This kind of view of survival of the fittest, or at least survival of the smartest. And I think that's actually a pretty misleading guide to what either armies or most other sorts of organizations do.
So you would suggest that this idea that strong organizations will dominate weaker ones is a bit delusional.
Yeah, I think it seems perfectly common sense when you first think about it. But the more reflection, I think the more difficult it becomes to hold these views. And one is that, well, in order to find out how you can make your organization more efficient, and that might be an army or that might be a government or a company or a university, you really have to know what causes what in the social world. And that's, in fact, extremely difficult. Secondly, even if you do figure out what causes what, then you have to be able to reform your organization, and that's usually, again, incredibly difficult.
Jason, in your studies on finance and business systems, do you see a Darwinian triumph there?
No, not at all. That it's instead organizations seem to be prone to fashions and fads, to herding behavior. And organizations, whether they're in the military sphere or the financial sphere, are instead more likely to be swayed as what's seen as legitimate or appropriate, rather than efficiency or effectiveness determining either what they do or how they structure themselves.
What about this idea of adaption, that Europeans were learning from the mistakes and adapting better and stronger, armies in particular?
Well, I think that, again, that's I'm a subscriber to the Nobody Knows Anything school of social inference or causal inference there. I mean, it's all very well to know that you lost a battle, for example, but it's entirely another matter to work out why you lost that battle. There could be lots of reasons: bad logistics, bad morale, bad leadership, bad technology. Maybe the opponent was just overwhelming superior. Maybe it was a fluke. Even if you can answer all of those questions, though, with perfect certainty, there's a difference between knowing what has to be done and being able to do it. So, for example, if you're the president of Iraq or Afghanistan now, you would probably think that your army would work a lot better if your regime weren't corrupt. But, of course, knowing that you have to reduce corruption in your government is very much easier to say that than to do it.
You are a heretic. You argue that leaders and managers at any given organization, the military, a university, perhaps even here at the ABC, rarely actually know what they're doing. In other words, nobody knows anything.
Yes, that's pretty much true. I'm sure the ABC is an exception, but for most other organizations, most of the time, I think that's true.
Do you observe it in universities?
Well, modesty forbids.
Cambridge.
Cambridge accepted, of course. But yes, I think in most of us for everyday life, we can see that people moan about bureaucracy, moan about committee meetings, moan about all sorts of other dysfunctions in the workplace. And yet they always seem to be there. We structure and restructure. We hire management consultants. And yet 2-3 years down the track, we've got to restructure in a different way. We've got to get some more management consultants. We've got to have more committee meetings about how to reduce the number of committee meetings we're all going to. So it's much more a theatre of the absurd view of the way that organisations do their business.
View of organisational life, it's a bit more like a Dilbert cartoon or an episode of The Office than it is like a sublime management text.
Exactly. It's not really McKinsey. It's much more Dilbert there.
Okay, what are some of the examples of weak states surviving past their, long past their use-by date?
Well, we can look at all of the tiny states in the world that, if you think that there are about 40 states that have a population of under 1 million, there are about 15 states that have a population of under 100,000, many of them in Australia's Pacific neighbourhood. We can think that about 35 states just don't have any armed forces at all. We can think that places like Andorra...
But you're talking about the micro-states like Andorra,
yeah, sure.
Liechtenstein.
Yeah, exactly, that survived the Second World War unscathed at times when, that you have obviously many states being conquered, destroyed, or at least severely damaged. So there's really no correlation between the strength of states in terms of their economy or their military and the likelihood that they'll survive the rigors of the international system or international war.
You talk also about the later Ottoman Empire lingering on, past its use-by date.
Yeah, again, there's this teleology whereby the end of the story, quote unquote, for Europeans is success. So it's the story of culminating success. The so-called end of the story for non-Western powers, the Ottomans, the Mughals, the various Chinese empires, is supposedly one of failure. After all, we overlook the fact that the Ottomans were around for a long time, 500 years, longer than the British Empire, and still, even in their last decade, were, of course, strong enough to be militarily effective, not least in turning back the Anzac landings.
Would you be kind enough to tell us about bulletproofing in the way you use the term?
Sure. So I look at an extreme example of where in Africa, but also in other places for many centuries, combatants have had the belief that if they drink certain magic potions or wear magic amulets, that they can become immune to bullets and therefore, of course, a lot more potent in battle. Now, of course, we know that this is not actually true, but for my purposes, the really astounding thing is if there were any belief that a militarily ineffective and, of course, downright dangerous, that we would expect to be eliminated through learning or through the fact of being shot, it would be this one. And yet, this strong cultural presumption in the power of magical bulletproofing not only has survived for long historical periods, but indeed in some parts of the world survives today.
Well, we saw it in Uganda, didn't we, in 86?
Indeed, there are many insurgencies historically in the 20th century and into the 21st century. And the example in Uganda of people thinking they could cover themselves with certain substances, march forward nearly naked in a long line, chanting certain psalms, but also chanting James Bond, and hoping that the Holy Spirit, which supposedly was in command of their army, would not only safeguard them from their opponent's fire, but also, of course, bring the victory in battle.
Do you think Donald Trump sometimes thinks he's bulletproof?
It's hard to tell what's going on there, but indeed, there do seem to be beliefs that are radically divorced from reality.
Ella Nell on RN, our first live program for the new year, and my guest is Jason Sharman. Jason is Professor of International Relations at the University of Cambridge, which, of course, like the ABC, is impervious to error. The book we're discussing is his Empires of the Weak, The Real Story of European Expansion and the Creation of the New World Order. I mentioned very much earlier in the program the conquistadors in the Americas. Are there other parallels more recent to that idea of overwhelming a vulnerable society?
Well, I think that certainly in the 19th century, particularly the late 19th century, this is in some ways the exception. The Europeans really were dominant, particularly in conquering Africa in the late 19th century, in cowing previously very powerful states in Asia, China and Japan. But even there, you can think, well, in some sense, why did the Europeans really want to do this? It's regarded as commonplace that that states have this innate drive, empire, for expansion across the seas. But again, rather than this being something that's natural and universal, it is rather peculiar to Western states. And again, if you look at the payoff for them in terms of building empires, it's much less clear in either economic or security terms than you might at first think.
We know that the sun never set on the British Empire, but you point out that there wasn't really an inevitability about Britain's rise, or indeed about the Dutch. And take the East India Company. It didn't start off as a centrally planned project.
No, that the Dutch and the British East India Companies were very much kind of ad hoc expedients. You had ambitious governments in Europe that didn't really have the money or the men to construct overseas colonies. So they embarked on what we now might call a public-private partnership of endowing these for-profit private institutions with all sorts of powers that we now associate with states, not least, of course, the power to build armies and navies, to conquer places and engage in international diplomacy. And indeed, they went forth and did this.
Jason, one of your big criticisms is directed at fellow academics who've written the history. You argue that there is a very implicit bias in the assumptions made by historians and international relations scholars. They hang on to their illusions and delusions.
Well, that might be putting it slightly harshly, but certainly I think that they've mistaken both the evidence and that there are these strong presumptions in terms of rational, efficient institutions that really don't hold up and that are misleading if we're trying to understand the present or the past, or if we're trying to gaze into the crystal ball and look what's ahead as well.
So you reckon empire wasn't necessarily a successful endeavour for the colonial powers, that they didn't necessarily get their money's worth?
No, I think far from it. In most cases, it was a rather loss-making prestige project that was to do with not so much military insecurity but cultural insecurity, whereby empire was seen as the marker of a great power. In order to be regarded as a great power, particularly those late on the stage, like unified Germany, unified Italy or Japan, was regarded to really prove your mettle as a great power. You had to have an empire, perhaps in the same way that now, to be a genuine great power, it's regarded that you have to have nuclear weapons.
The empire, okay. You say the West's heyday. Even then, you could see the seeds of its decline. And I guess one of the biggest came along with the use of guerrilla armies.
Exactly. It's commonplace now, but even at the time when the West was being most successful, say already from the beginning of the 20th century, there were precursors of what was to come, as even if the West was winning in places like South Africa in the Boer War or in the interwar period in North Africa with the French and Spanish, that it was becoming increasingly difficult, that European powers were having to mobilize hundreds of thousands of troops in a way that's familiar from the failed counterinsurgency campaigns that we saw during decolonization in the few decades after the Second World War, but also, of course, is familiar to us now from recent experience from Iraq and Afghanistan.
What could Australian policymakers learn from your book in terms of our place in Asia?
Well, I think first off that if the 21st century is to be an Asian century, and who knows, social scientists are lousy at predictions, that in fact this is not so much unprecedented, this is not uncharted territory, but in fact is a return to the norm. And in fact, for most of the time, we've had international relations across different civilizations. Western civilization has been at best at parity and sometimes at inferiority. So in fact, we're going back to the normal state of affairs, and we shouldn't really be that surprised if we had, in broad historical terms, a brief anomalous period of Western superiority.
And should we be afraid, or should we be a bit more relaxed about the changing power reality?
I think we shouldn't really be that afraid, at least we should be afraid only to the extent our conception of self is wrapped up with this idea of natural, inevitable Western superiority. I think that, you know, if we have that, we're going to be disillusioned sooner or later. I think this is not only factually wrong, but it's also very misleading as a guide to policy as to what we should do, but also what we are.
So, in summary, ladies and gentlemen, victory does not always go to those with the most advanced technology, the largest armies, and the most developed state apparatus. Thank you very much, Jason. Jason Sharman's book is called Empires of the Weak. Not Empire of the Weak, Empires of the WEAK. It's the real story of European expansion and the creation of the New World Order. And for some reason that I never understand, it's not published by Cambridge, but by Princeton University Press.